Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Roy, a commercial interior designer with a passion for creating beautiful functional spaces. Over the years, I've worked on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a wealth of knowledge, which I'm excited to share with you. I started this podcast because I believe in the power of interior design. So much of what we need to know as designers, you won't learn in a classroom. Whether you're an aspiring designer, tackling your home project, or a seasoned pro, this podcast is for you. Season 2 is here, and I couldn't be more thrilled to kick things off with some fresh energy and exciting changes. This season, I'm joined by not one, but two incredible co-hosts, Hannah Denny and Scarlett Mallett. Together, we're diving deeper into the world of design to bring you more perspectives, lively debates, and all the tips and tricks you need to thrive. We're here to offer practical advice, discuss the latest trends, and give you unfiltered, real-world insights. Expect honest conversations, a bit of humour, and maybe even the occasional strong opinion and language. Remember, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. And if you're a sound editor looking for a fun collaboration, let us know. We'd love to have you on board. Thanks for tuning in to season 2 of the Interior Design Podcast. So, hello, welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. Today, we're joined by John Rensink from Daniel Connell Partnership, who is a partner, and we're going to talk about CDM in architecture and interior design. We're also joined by Hannah. And Hannah is very new at CDM, so we're looking forward to learning, or Hannah is looking forward, I hope.
Yeah, I am very much so.
To learning a lot from John today, and we would love to teach our listeners as well. So thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thank you.
Did you want to introduce yourself and let us know what you do?
Yeah, so John Rensing from Daniel Connell Partnership, health and safety advisor. Been there since 1999. Saw an opportunity at Daniel Connell Partnership. Went for the interview, got the job, expected to go around all the departments, health and safety, QS, BS, but ended up getting stuck in the health and safety department. And here I am, still with them 25 years later, getting to meet, you know, great people like yourselves on some amazing schemes over the years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what I do is not the littlest possible phrase, but to as much as I can to help people and those that want help. I enjoy
them.
Working with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoy working with. So, don't like podcasting though. No. So
I think
this isn't
for me. We're working
nervous.
On you.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
We just
not
had
sure
a great hug.
Not sure how much you're going to learn off the back of this, but let's
go. I'm learning
right,
already. So what is CDM?
CDM stands for Construction Design and Management Regulations. Okay, and when I started in 1999, we had the what was known as Plan Supervisor, and then in 2007, we had CDM Coordinator. CDM Coordinator was sort of a standalone role, just seeing the health and safety side of a scheme, and then they changed it back in 2015, and that's where, under these Construction Design Management Regulations, you've got the various duty holder roles, of you'll have a client, designers, contractors, everybody's got duties to discharge, with consideration to how a scheme will be delivered. Used and maintained in the future, health and safety wise.
Okay.
So, you know, in a nutshell, it's just trying to, you know, bring a bit of school of thought to health and safety, whether it be building it or using it and maintaining it in the future. Yeah. It's been lovely having you here. We'll let you get on now. Yeah.
So John, how does CDM apply to architects and interior designers?
How does it apply? Well, there's lots of people out there who maybe still not fully aware or don't fully understand what CDM's about. And it shouldn't detract away, is it? What architects and interior designers enjoy doing. You know, they're there to enjoy what they're doing, but just put a bit of thought into the health and safety side. So whether that be the design side of things, what you design in so that it's safe to use, build, bring into the site, install, and then use and maintain in the future, you know, what you're designing, is it? Whoever, you know, who you're designing for as a school, do they have the funds to be able to maintain this, that, or the other sort of thing in the future? So it's thinking about the design process, not just from a health and safety construction, but also how they're going to maintain it in the future. It's just making sure that right from day one you go in and, you're telling the client that they've got duties, and part of those duties is to make sure that you identify information that needs to be shared on schemes, be it asbestos surveys, you could say, identifying any challenges associated with that site that need a little bit of thought. And then the design side, in, as I say, just making sure that whatever you design is safe to build, use, maintain in the future.
So at Daniel Connell, do you support people?
Yeah. So we can offer a variety of roles. You've got the actual principal designer role, if you know, and we'll take it on if it's appropriate to take on. Or we could act as a CDM advisor, so to speak, and advise, whether it be the architect, just standalone with supported architects, mm-hmm. With regards to their own duties, you know, relevant of them taking on this principal designer role.
So you say,
which we'll explain and search.
Yeah, I was going to say, principal designer, does that entail?
Or clients, we support clients separately, mm-hmm. if there's a need to help them in making sure that everybody they've appointed is doing what they should be doing. Mm-hmm. The principal designer role is that, you could say, overarching designer, mm-hmm. who's got a number of duties to make sure that almost every other designer is discharging their duties appropriately as well. So I've got some notes down as to exactly what the regulations show they should be doing, which we could always touch on quickly and have a look through. It might make it a little bit clearer, because there might be one or two at home that are sort of thinking, well, yeah, he's waffling
what
a bit here.
What
we're actually meant to do. But first and foremost, I need to find those notes. So I shall mumble for a bit. Here we are. Regulation 9. Okay. So Regulation 9 of the Construction Design and Management Regulations. Okay. These are applicable to designers. Mm-hmm. They set duties on the designers. And I'll just read out a few of those duties that it states. Okay. So these include the duty to eliminate, reduce, and control foreseeable health and safety risks through the design process, such as those that may arise during construction or in maintaining and using the building in the future.
Okay.
It says a designer must not commence work in relation to a project unless satisfied that the client is aware of their duties. Right. So for anybody that's at home that's an architect or an interior designer right now, what do you currently do to make the client aware of their duties?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We've got it in our quotes. So in every quote that we send out, there's a link to your duties, so that we're kind of naturally doing that.
Yeah.
We would often have that conversation anyway, but
maybe I should read that.
Would
have really been helpful.
Well, yeah.
No, it's still.
But that's just client responsibility. Yeah. So it's not principal designer responsibilities either. So
it's designer. And we had a job which we actually appointed on. We made it clear we were senior advisor to the client, and then they were scratching their heads about what this principal designer role is, and they thought we were also going to be doing
that
principal designer role.
Okay.
I said, no, this is who has designed it. There's a contractor appointed. The works are starting in Feb. This is a big residential scheme, commercial residential project.
Mm. How can a residential project be commercial? What do you mean by that?
Because within this building, it's got a number of apartments, basically. So they're all let out.
Right.
So if the client's making money off the property, they're not going to live in it. They're going to make money off the property and it becomes a commercial scheme.
Right,
and this sort of caused a few issues. And, you know, I'm trying to break down what the client duties are, and I'm breaking down what the principal designer duties are. And there's some crossovers, like the preparation of pre-construction information and making sure the construction phase plan is developed. So I'm sort of saying, if it looks like you've currently assumed these duties of the principal designer, which is basically what happens under the CDM regs, is until the client appoints a designer to act as principal designer, the client on commercial schemes assumes that role.
Okay.
So right at this moment in time, I've got a client that's evidently not very happy that he was never told about this principal designer role, and he had to appoint someone to be discharging these duties. So it's so important that designers do find the right way to firstly tell their client. CDM regulations apply. It's likely we're going to have more than one contractor. So the principal designer role is required where there will be more than one contractor or trade involved on scheme, which is most projects. So there needs to be the appointment of the principal designer. So it needs to be made in writing, and ideally it's got to be a designer that's got relevant knowledge for the scope of works that's about to be delivered, or they go out and find either support in that role, or they'll find someone independent that's able to assist in delivery of that role.
So there's three roles: client, principal designer, principal contractor.
That's it. Yeah, and the client has to make those two roles, principal contractor and principal designer. They need to appoint them in writing, and until done so, the client will assume both roles.
Okay.
So if the client has appointed somebody in writing, would that include, so for example, if I'm a designer and I'm going to send out a quote, on the quote it says principal designer, and then the client has to pay a deposit to action the quote, that's them doing that in writing?
Yes.
Yeah?
As long as it's instructed in some form of way that says the client has instructed you, we accept your proposal, that states within it, we will be acting as principal designer, you know, in accordance with so-and-so regulations, then we've got template forms that make it easier and it can be documented. But God forbid something goes wrong in the court of law, they just want to see something that says the client has acknowledged and signed something that says, yes, accept your quotation for you to discharge those duties. I'll just quickly just touch on a couple of other points. So the first one was about just making sure the client's aware of their duties. When preparing or modifying a design, the designer must take into account the general principles of prevention and any pre-construction information to eliminate, so far as it's reasonably practicable, foreseeable risks to health and safety, either carrying out or liable to be affected by the construction work, maintaining or cleaning, or using the structure designed as a workplace. Whatever you're thinking about designing, as I was sort of touching on, it's just thinking about how could your design increase risks posed to those, be it through a construction phase or through a future use and maintenance process. So you've got a duty bound to make sure that you find a way of recording the risks maybe associated with your designs. Okay, so that information can be shared with other parties, inclusive of the principal designer and the client. Where it's not possible to eliminate risks, the designer must, so far as reasonably, take steps to reduce or control the risks through subsequent design process, which might be liaising with the contractor and talking to them about how can we do this, how can we manage this risk, provide information about the risks to the principal designer, and also ensure appropriate information is provided, which needs to be included in the health and safety file. There's been examples in the past where a designer's designed this very unique cantilevered reception table. I can't really go into too many details about it. Similar shape to your logo. Very unique, you know, it'll be eye-catching, quite an iconic feature. So we're thinking how it can be designed and it's not going to topple over, or it's not going to cause any issues to customers coming into this retail environment. You go through the whole design process. It goes off to be manufactured in country abroad, comes back to the point where the shop front's been completed and you can get it through the front door. So it had to be broken down. So it's sort of the most simplest of things that right from the beginning it should have been thought about.
It's common sense, isn't it?
But it happens all the
operations,
time.
Operations, isn't it? And the order of things.
Yeah, it does. It happens all the time in different ways, shapes and forms.
I have a question. What's the difference between an O&M manual and a health and safety file?
Operation and maintenance manual, basically. So, and that's got all the information within it. How to operate and maintain, in particular respects, say flooring,
fabrics and things like
that. Yeah, that's it. Electrical side of things, mechanical side of things, sprinkler systems, fire alarm. That's what's been installed and this is how to maintain it and service it in the future. And that will usually come with some as-built drawings and certificates, whereas the health and safety file probably looks more at residual risks or anything that needs to be recorded in a certain way. Asbestos reports, this was what's removed, but this is what's been encapsulated within it. You identify that. This is the roots of maybe some services that aren't identifiable on sets of other as-built drawings, so we just need to make you aware that there's a service HV cable or something running across this site.
When you do CDM, when you do principal designer role, would you put an O&M manual in with a health and safety file?
Try and combine it and collaborate it together. Really, the health and safety file's got to be about what do we need to tell them that might not be so obvious, so you might have some particular coatings that you can't paint over or screw into or something like that. So this, it's all your residual risks, so to speak, or anything else that needs to be thought of.
Can anyone do that, or do you have to have a course?
To do an O&M manual.
Be principal designer,
CDM and competence is so important. So from the outset, as far as they were concerned, the likes of HSE, Association of Project Safe, their thought was, well, people should be competent enough anyway.
Right.
When it comes to design, we should all be competent enough to be able to have a look and see what our designs are and how they could impact those who are going to go about constructing them and using them and maintaining them in the future. But yes, everybody's got a duty bound to maintain their CPD. Lots of courses through Association of Project Safety who oversee the whole CDM side of things. So there's some great courses on there, which we could share in the links at the end.
You guys do one on your website as well, don't you?
Yeah, CDM we do some. There's obviously the virtual e-learning ones, which are good refreshers. I'm not a big promoter, you could say, of e-learning, but more. They're good sort of refresher, you could say, courses. And we do classroom-based CPD sessions where we try and focus on the particular parts of CDMs. We try and be helpful, so to speak, rather than just that overview, which also at the same time, it appears even to this day, the overview is so important because people do.
And does it change a lot? It's been quite standard for the whole time. I suppose building regulations and things change.
That's the thing, it's, you know, what else changes building regs-wise, as we were touching on earlier about certain things that have to be done now from a building regs side of things.
That might be a good opportunity for us to talk about the difference between building reg principal designer and CDM principal designer. Could maybe talk about that?
Something that, how could I put it? The CDM principal designer is very much about the design and the health and safety side. The building regs principal designer is really very much about just making sure he's built in accordance with building regs.
Yeah.
It should be, in theory, something quite straightforward, but it does really increase that requirement for communication and collaboration with other designers. And we're doing it on a few schemes, and it's quite good in that way because we found a way of recording what needs to be done to make sure what is being designed is done in accordance with building regs, yeah. You know, breaking down all the different building regs parts, pulling together questions that we want answers on. So actually it's sort of improved the approach to collaborating with other designers, mm-hmm. but it's very much just about making sure that what's built or completed is done in accordance with the building regs. Whereas the CDM side of things is, as I say at the beginning, it's making sure you get the information you need in respect to the site, logistical health and safety side, and then just making sure what you design is safe to build, use and maintain in the future. Sitting schoolboy terms, so to speak.
We started off this podcast and Jonathan didn't have his mic on, so we had to do it all.
Here we are. Oh, scattered. Yeah,
so no. Jonathan again. John. Yeah. It's not Jonathan, it's John.
Yeah, I get called lots of names. So, a designer must take all reasonable steps to provide sufficient information about their design to adequately assist the client, other designers and contractors comply with their duties under the regs. So again, you know, think about if you're a designer watching this. How do you share information? Mm-hmm. Do you just pass it to the client and say, what do you think of this nice picture, so to speak? Or, you know, how do you share it with everybody that needs to be made aware of what you foresee as being the end goal when you walk into the room and you see it? This is how I envisaged it. But it's also easy to find yourself at the end of a scheme where you walk into the room and go, why is that there? Or what's going on here? Or the client saying, I've got mechanical equipment up there that I need to maintain and there's this feature here that's now in the way. Why was it never communicated to me about, you know, this being here or that being there? So it's just sharing information between the team to make sure that, as I say, it's we all get the end product we want and that what is within there can be used and maintained safely in the future. So think about how you're currently sharing information with anybody who be involved on the projects. And there's different ways you can do that as well. So
we've been recently asked to reduce the amount of information that we give to contractors. So we've got a design pack, which quite often is like 100 pages long. Right. And the contractors are going, you need to like stop information overloading us.
Right.
So we've got to kind of figure out what that looks like.
Right.
It's just a particular contractor that we work with a lot. And they've kind of gone, right, we need to streamline this. But I always find the more information, the better. The more detail you go into, the better. But I'm apparently information overload, so I need to sort
that. When you've got so many schemes going on, it's easy to, it's not just you, it's all of us, you know, all these schemes, you get a lot of information thrown at you. And it's what routes do you use? Do you use virtual platforms? Do you upload it on, you know, Dropbox or Google Drive platforms that allow you to make sure you're sharing what needs to be shared and you're making it very clear when things are updated, so it's easier for these people to get access rather than keep getting attachments in emails.
We send a link to the
file. We do links, so we use OneDrive and we send a link to the OneDrive because all the information that we send generally in a design pack will be quite big, so we can't really email attach it anyway, so we'll send a link that says the update. And if we're working on a project where there's a lot of updates, then and as you go through, we just have a drawing log.
Right, okay. The other point, as I say, we touched on was about how you're going to take into account this general principles of prevention. So it's that, you know, how do you design out risk? How firstly do you look at your drawings? Do you think, okay, what needs to be maintained in the future? What could be a challenge when it comes to manufacturing it and bringing it in the end product? How are we documenting these things just to make sure everybody's aware, not just the client? Okay, lovely feature, but you now need to think about how you're going to clean these curtains in the future that are 4 or 5 meters in the air, you know. Just having a good think about how you foresee someone that end goal. I think there was a project where we had a feature that come the end of the scheme, artificial lighting was inadequate. So the client had to have a light turned on at all times. I think it went 4 meters in height. So it's difficult for the light to actually get up there and change the light bulb as well. So it's just thinking about this is what it's going to look like, but providing it to other parties to say, all right, you're not going to get much artificial lighting coming in there. So how do we change and adapt the scope, because it might seem something quite innocuous when it's just a feature, but actually it could create risks in other ways. So it's thinking about, you know, what do you need to document, to write down and share it with other parties and just make sure that you're recording what needs to be recorded.
It's also getting the client buy-in as well, isn't it? So if a light does need to be maintained and it's a height, that client's got to be able to
change it.
Be interested in being part of doing that, because it is going to be more risky than not having it. So having that client buy-in in the first place is really important, because if they don't buy in, they won't do it, and then it becomes more of a health and safety risk if there's 100%. Not enough light.
Communication and collaboration are so important. Mm. So just keep communicating and keep recording and sharing this information, because it's such a fast-paced world. It can get easily missed. and other priorities can come along. And yeah.
Do you have a document that you have to think about?
We have a few that we could, you know, share with any listeners on how you can record things. Yeah. You can do it in different ways. You could, if you think there's something that needs to be drawn to the attention of everyone, write a number on the drawing, mm-hmm. you know, and then refer it to a separate document so it's easily identifiable, you know, have number one there and someone will look at the drawing, okay, what's that about? And then they'll be able to see it. So, you know, you can either write notes on drawings, which mm-hmm. will help. We've got risk registers that we can share that, mm. that break down different elements, whether you're acting as the designer mm-hmm. or whether you're acting as a principal designer where you want something with a little bit more depth
yeah.
to it. So, yeah.
We've got a checklist, haven't we, that we use?
We have.
With lots of things on it, just to make sure that we're going through and ticking it off to make sure that we've done everything, which we'll put in. We'll create a folder at the beginning of the project and do it like that.
Communication and information sharing.
Yeah.
And finding the best way to do that is easier.
We were talking about this morning, weren't we? If we've got a big project, we won't manage the PD role ourselves.
No.
PD, principal designer.
Yeah.
Because it's just too big.
Yeah.
You know?
You need to be comfortable you've got the resource to be able to deliver it and put the time into focusing
on it. We would always ring
it.
You at that point.
Yeah.
John.
Tristan. No idea why. So I was just also going to touch on Regulation 11 then. That sets out the duties of the principal designer role. Mm-hmm. So I'm only reading out one or two of the points here. Principal designer must plan, manage and monitor the pre-construction phase and coordinate matters relating to health and safety during the pre-construction phase to ensure that, so far as is reasonably practicable, the project is carried out without risk to health and safety. So out there right now, there will be architects and interior designers maybe who assume that role of principal designer mm-hmm. on domestic schemes where it's not classed as commercial scheme, you know, the client's not going to rent the property out or anything along those lines, then on those schemes, the client's duties will usually get passed, or the principal contractor who ends up getting appointed will assume those client duties. Mm-hmm. But the lead architect will assume the role of the principal designer. So at some point or another, it's likely most architects or interior designers will pick up this role of principal designer and have mm-hmm. these responsibilities. And it doesn't have to, as I say, this shouldn't be anything scary. Mm-hmm. It's just having some simple processes in place. And as I say, looking at an environment and thinking, okay, what surveys might be needed, what further information, what logistical challenges might there be, and what information do we need to be, you know, sharing with the contractor that ends up winning the job. So at least we've done our part, so to speak, even if we don't end up being involved in the whole scheme and the contractor delivering the remainder of the role. We've thought about these things.
What's the worst that could happen? You say it's not scary, but what's the worst that could happen? Like if there was an accident?
There's various prosecutions out there. I did jot one or two down, just thinking off the top of my head. One was in relation to an architect. They were prosecuted because they were provided with a copy of an asbestos survey, but they didn't share it with a contractor. And for one reason or another, the contractor didn't pick up the reason that they needed this survey neither. The architect had it, should have shared it. They didn't. Contractor broke some asbestos. So even though the contractor as well should have said, hang on a minute, I need an asbestos survey.
Mm. Designer, isn't it? That's the top, the buck stops there.
Another architect designed something that required work at height to maintain it, but there were inadequate provisions designed to be able to safely maintain that, and someone fell from height. So again, it came back to the architect as well for, you could say, not thinking about how the thing could be suitably maintained in the future.
I was at a women's networking event this week, and I sat next to a lady called Bee, and I told her that I would ask you this question. She is working as an architectural technologist in a company, and the company want her to train as principal designer. So it's a contract, and so that she can manage that role. Now, she's concerned about her responsibilities. So for example, if somebody else designs it within the company and then she signs it off as principal designer and it's not right, what point does it become her personal responsibility? So for example, you've got a company responsibility. So say for example, if Harp Design was principal designer on a project, we're insured if anything goes wrong. But if a particular person within that company is taking on a responsibility, are they personally responsible?
Yeah. So firstly, if Harp Interiors were
Harp
happy
Design.
To Harp Designs, that's why I couldn't find you.
You've been doing that for years.
Harp Design, when they deliver the PD role, you should have some form of policy in place and quality assurance approach to delivery of the role. And it shouldn't be complex, but, you know, these are the duties as I'm reading out, and this is how we'll deliver this PD role. So then you should be training Hannah in respect of how we are to discharge the role of PD. So B should be getting training internally on what is the QA approach to deliver. And that would be the starting point. And then the point after that is reflect on what are the duties of the principal designer role and where do we think we need to improve knowledge and competence. But you've established that through appraisals and saying, look, I'm doing this role, but I don't know enough about this part or this part. Who do I turn to ask that question?
But she was worried about if somebody was to give her some drawings and she would check them and she thought they were okay and then something happened, would she be personally liable?
I don't think she should be the one that's proving them at any point. She should just be posing the questions and having a look. Yeah, you know, certainly a second opinion, which is where additional training comes in. But it's also, you know, knowledge comes in as well. We're all always learning. So we're never going to be able to spot every risk on a bit of paper. So, you know, she's got the relevant training that goes with understanding what are typical risks, then that's fine. But the person that's designing it in the first place has got duties to make sure they're identifying where there are risks. They're the ones that are knowledgeable in respect of what they're designing. So it can't always come down just simply to her. I would have thought the company's approach is that if you're going to lead in the PD role, this is our QA approach, so to speak, on how we'll do it. Mm-hmm. Can you just make sure that we are getting the pre-construction information, so to speak, the asbestos surveys first, and we're getting what we need. Mm-hmm. And if we have a design meeting, you're asking the structural engineer, is there anything that they need? You know, have you got all the surveys you need? And then as you work down the list from a risk register point of view, say, you could say our hazard risk register at Daniel Connell would be broken down into various sections. The first section talks about what is the site, logistical challenges. Okay, the second section is survey information. What have we got and what needs to be prepared? The third section might be about the design process and what needs to be identified to contract actors' attention for, say, substructure and in superstructure side. And then at the end, what needs to be identified in respect of future use and maintenance for the client, the end user. So it's always just having a nice, easy risk register that's really easy to understand. So, if B's got that in front of her and that assists her along the way in thinking, all right, have we been provided with the information that we need, or do we have to go out and get more surveys, talk to the design team and others?
So that's like collating things.
Yeah, basically, it's just trying to provide some peace of mind that if, God forbid, something, you get to the end of a project and you find something that the client's saying, how am I going to maintain this, or how am I going to use it, or you've got a feature that, as I say, can't be secured in a certain way. How did you get to that point? How did people communicate along the way?
I suppose if you're a PD within a company, as long as you are doing that communication, you are doing your role, aren't you? And actually, even if you were to put into a health and safety file or into the paperwork that you're doing for the PD role, the responsibilities of the people within the company, that actually then takes the pressure off of her a little bit in terms of not just her doing the PD role, it's actually the designer's responsibility to design it as long as you've asked the questions.
100%. Everybody's got duties to discharge. Not one individual's just got to be there to keep nudging people and keep things moving when it comes to how we're going to deliver this scheme, so it's not going to impact anybody who's not involved, to those that are involved, to those that have to use it in the future. Collaboration, finding really, really useful ways of being able to share information, as well as appropriate ways of use of virtual platforms for meetings and that. Just keep having meetings, as so to speak, as regularly as you can. But
and record the meetings.
And record them. But very much, break them down. Just have one-to-one meetings with a structural engineer. Just have one-to-one meetings and talk through. We've got a simple agenda for it that's got literally 4 points on it, which I'm happy to share again. 4 points that run through, touch on the CDM side, and there you've got it recorded as to where maybe information isn't coming through that a particular designer really, really needs, and it allows you to go away and just talk to another designer and say, look, what's the score with this or that, or why isn't it happening? And then try different ways of trying to make sure that what everybody is doing, they are doing, so you don't get to a point. It's not as complex and scary.
It isn't as scary. I should just say that.
Just, it's very simple in a way, but unfortunately, as I say, if you don't communicate your client from the very beginning, then you might not find that the right people are getting appointed at the right time and the right information isn't coming along at the right time. And everybody's got a lot of pressures on, and, all of a sudden one project can slide away sometimes. Mm. So it's just finding the right way to maintain communication and stay on top of things. So it shouldn't be that complex whatsoever.
No.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I find a lot of people in who are residential interior designers don't understand CDM at all, which is one of the reasons why I really wanted to do this podcast. Mm. My understanding of it is that residential interior designers don't need to take on a principal designer role if the contractor takes on the principal designer role and the principal contractor role.
Right.
Is that right?
It depends the approach. You know, as the residential client phoned up Hannah or Bailey Roy and said, we want to do an extension and, you know, convert our garage into a nice open plan kitchen space. Well, you're there from the off and you've assumed that PD role straight away. Mm. So you're going in.
So that's not true then, is it? So I have a question.
Yes.
Residential interior design and commercial interior design, do residential interior designers need to know about CDM and principal designer? Because a lot of designers that I've met have said that the contractor takes on the principal designer and the principal contractor role.
Yeah,
if they're doing interiors,
is it?
If it's an architecture project,
yeah,
I can understand that you'd need it. But if it was just interiors and it was just decorating and flooring and things like that, how does that work?
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. They certainly should know about CDM as a start point. They're the designer, so they should certainly know about their duties as a designer. When it comes to the domestic schemes, I guess it's how did it all come about? If the client's approached them and says, I want to do this, that and the other with this place of work, then in theory, if there is no other designer involved, then they are assuming that principal designer role, as long as it's defined as construction work, which most things are. Construction work. Yeah, we could always do a link to the definition of what construction work is at the end of this. It's doing a bit of, so to speak, construction work is that comes under the definition. So you'd think if their interior designer was the only person appointed at that stage, then they'd assume the role and they'd have quite an important role, because even if it was just some interior decoration works, then you've still got
do the maintenance, you know, O&M.
Yeah, but right from the beginning, you're still going to need most likely an asbestos survey, depending on the age of building. That person might live there. So it's thinking about a little bit logistically about, you know, I've helped contractors on the domestic scheme, and I can tell you so many have come to me and asked, can we pull a letter together or something that we can share with our residential client, because they're not getting it when it comes to the health and safety risks that are posed, and we're doing our best to, you know, mitigate the risks and separate off areas, but how do we manage discharging our duties? So it's even more important from on a domestic scheme, the interior designers are a little bit clued up, so to speak, as to, all right, this could be a challenge here. It's, you know, certain projects, the client's not going to be moved out. So if they want something fancy come the end of this, we've got to think carefully about how maybe we can deliver this scheme. And that includes what I'm designing. The space might be restricted. There's not a lot of room to be storing stuff here and that. So how can we make sure that what we design and how it will be further developed, or any further design development that contractor will take on, they've got as much information as they need. I guess that's where maybe you go back to the interior designer and their initial discussions with the client. Client's not highly unlikely to be very clued up on CDM regulations. Contractors, again, they assume the role or the duties of the client on domestic schemes. So, you know, it's that educating side of things. So firstly, just make sure interior designers educate themselves on CDM regulations, so they're in a position that when it comes to saying, all right, we'll go and find a contractor now, just sharing the odd question to these contractors and saying, are you aware of the CDM regulations? Are you aware of some of the duties that goes on? Is there a point where you're going to have more responsibilities when it comes to design than I am? So somewhere we need to record that you'll be taking on the designer role now. It won't be with me anymore because I can't have the influence on the design. You're going away and going to design this. You're going to figure out routes for this. So you're in a much stronger position to be taking on those design responsibilities. So we need to somehow record that, you know, as an interior designer, I'm no longer going to be the principal designer. So there has to be a point where it's just communication and collaboration. You know, there's nothing that's fixed and says it must be done this way.
Mm.
Just pure and simply on domestic schemes, duties of the principal designer goes to the architect, the lead designer, so to speak, and the duties of the client goes to the contractor when they're appointed principal contractor or contractor. So, yeah.
So on commercial education scheme, the client has more responsibility
Oh, absolutely.
Than
yeah.
a domestic scheme.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, can't expect domestic clients to be clued up on CEM. Mm. There's guidance out there, and then again, we can share that at the end of this podcast from the Association of Project Safety, specific to domestic projects. So that's quite a useful sort of 3 or 4 page document, and it breaks it all down. So, you know, we'll do a link to that.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you.
But yeah, when it comes to commercial, all commercial clients need to, well, not all. I say not all. Commercial clients need to be clued up, but there's many clients, as we've worked with clients that come from abroad for retail, restaurants, you know, that aren't clued up on CDM. So that's
We work with a lot of restaurants or hotels, and they would refurb once every 5 or 10 years. So, you know, they might not remember, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
How far are we away from 2015?
Yeah.
we're not yet 10 years, are we? So
no.
10 years ago, they didn't need to have it. So,
well, they've had it under the old rigs. That's the thing. Under the previous, you know, all the way back to 94, they'll always have duties. It's just, to this day, there's so many clients that will say, what's this CDM about and what's this principal design?
People don't want to pay for it, do they?
And I don't, you know, I don't really understand what it is. But as I say, you know, captured a few prosecutions. There's many prosecutions out there.
But you have to have it when you've got more than one contractor, is that right?
The principal designer and principal contractor role, yes. Where there'll be more than one contractor or more than one trade, there is the requirements for the appointment. The CDM regulations apply. As long as it's a definition of construction work, they apply on all schemes.
Okay.
So, you know, even to this day, I have people getting in touch and saying, we need your help now, John, because the project's notifiable. It's over 30 days and it's, forget about the notifiable part. CDM regulations apply on all schemes as long as they're defined as construction work.
Okay. So decorators, flooring contractors.
Yeah, that's it.
Even if it was, so when it's one contractor.
Yeah.
Does that mean one company or so, one person?
No, just one company. So if they have to subcontract anything out, even if it's a small bit of scaffold, then in theory, that's a second contractor trade going to be required. So the whole PDPC, but it's just done in proportion to what the scope of works are. But we've got a lift scheme going on. It's just that one contractor, and that's fine. As soon as they bring someone in to do a bit of fire stopping, or if there's a requirement for a scaffold, then it becomes two contractors, even if that contractor's only on site for 1 or 2 days sort of thing. But it's all got to be done in proportion, you know. Go back to what I said at the beginning. It's all about what information do we need to deliver this scheme? What do we need to be aware of logistically around here? And what are we actually doing? What does the client need to know when it comes to building, using, maintaining it in the future? It's not meant to be complex. It's not meant to be complex at all, but there shouldn't be reasons as those prosecutions why architects and haven't passed an asbestos survey they've been given to people, or contractors not even asked for it anyway. You know, there shouldn't be prosecutions where, what else have we had out there? Just being aware of the logistical challenges. There's one by a school where, very tragically, unfortunately, a child managed to get into the construction site. You know, so from site security, how could such inadequate measures be put in place? If someone wants to get into a site, they'll get into a site, but you can't have provisions where it's literally left open and someone could just walk in. And there was, I think, something failed on the structure, hit a member of public below, you know, and that came back to the PD, principal designer and principal contractor, because they didn't manage that risk. Whereas from a logistical nature, it's working so close to public and it wasn't considered how those works would be delivered, and something fell from height. The other one was, I think I touched on it earlier, about the architect designing something that required future maintenance at height, and the provisions put in place to be able to maintain it were inadequate. I think it was parapet wall or something was too low and person fell. And so, you know, it's just thinking carefully about what are the most significant risks, not general risks, not trip hazards or anything like this. You know, it's thinking about what could be the things that we need to look, work your way backwards is what I would say. Whatever health and safety role you're in, just look at what you're about to do and then work your way backwards. What could go wrong? Things will go wrong, but do your best to think about how you tried to mitigate it, and along that way, how did you record it and share it with others?
And John, how does CDM influence project timelines and budgets and overall management of a project?
Joys of timelines. Where can I start? When it comes to timelines, as I say, touched on information sharing. So many schemes where someone will think, oh, I think we'll get John involved now, or, you know, the Daniel Connell team involved from a health and safety side of things. And hopefully we're going to provide the support at whatever point that support is required. But more so, too many times we get brought on board and you'll say, okay, where's the asbestos survey? And there isn't one in place. Yeah, there's a contractor appointed and they've tendered it. They're at a point of, I don't know why it's not been discussed, why it's not been raised. But again, you know, where's the asbestos survey? And we had one scheme. I can't go into too many details, but it was ridiculous that it was for a commercial client, a council, and asbestos survey hadn't been identified, and it ended up they got a survey carried out, found a lot of asbestos in it. It was going to cost too much, and the project was ceased.
You can spend a lot of money before you get there, can't you?
How did that happen, and why have people, for whatever reason, decided, let's just carry on with the design, the procurement process, get to the point, and then that's nothing, get a survey done, get rid of it, and it costs too much. The other one is from a budget side of things, from a designing, just think outside the box when it comes to doing the designs. And we had a scheme where there was a mechanical design, a bit of plant to go on the roof, standard bit of equipment, standard design, would need to be craned onto the roof. Nothing exciting about it, all straightforward, as long as it's done safely, all straightforward, absolutely fine. But then a year later, they went onto the next floor to do the next phase, similar bit of plant again, needed to go onto the roof, but a different mechanical designer came along, and they looked at it and broke this bit of equipment down into smaller parts. Mm. So it could be gone straight in through the building, up a lift. So it cost money, it saved time, it saved worry from that sort of thing. But if that opportunity is there in the first place, then, think outside the box as to how you're going to do it. And you can, it's just a good memory jogger that it's not just simply about drawing something on a bit of paper. It's thinking about, how can we achieve that, and how can we
get it in there?
Yeah.
I think we've got to the point now where when we take on a project, we'll have an asbestos survey. And it's not just, I think it's quite important to note that it's not just an asbestos survey. If you're doing refurbishment, it's an asbestos demolition survey you need.
Refurbishment and demolition.
Refurbishment,
survey.
Refurbishment
survey.
And also things like drainage surveys, surveys for air conditioning and things like that. Because, I've got a client at the moment who is about to sign a lease, and she's asked me to design sort of a little bit at risk because she hasn't signed the lease yet on a new property. But I've advised her to get a drainage survey, air conditioning survey, and an asbestos survey, because before she signs the lease, she might actually find something that the landlord hasn't declared is there, and she's got room for negotiation. So, it's a really good place to start, because you're very aware of things. And, if you don't have an air conditioning survey or a drainage survey, you could end up getting to the point where you're completely ready to open. And then the toilet doesn't work, or something happens, and it's just sort of risk management, isn't it, really?
Having the survey. Absolutely. It should be quite enjoyable, actually. So, taking on board the duties of CDM right from the beginning, it should be actually a feel-good factor out of it. Yeah. If you do identify these issues early on, rather than halfway through the project.
Because it can delay everything, can't it, if you don't get it.
Why wasn't this picked up earlier? Mm. And sometimes it's just, you could say, pressures of life, and we just haven't thought through this one part that maybe a lot of people don't want to deal with or take note of. I don't know.
What are your key takeaways from this?
Key takeaways? A bit of advice or to someone, sort of thing.
What advice have you got for designers and architects?
As I say, don't let CDM detract away from what you enjoy doing as architects or interior designers. When it comes to, you've got duties to discharge, just be open-minded, as I keep repeating about. You're going into a site thinking about, all right, what information do we need to know? What information would we need to be sharing with other people in the future? What logistical challenges that could there be within this setting, whether it's retail or whether it's at a school or something along those lines? Where could we find challenges when it comes to the actual delivery of the scheme where accidents or issues could occur? And what do we need to think about design-wise that we should be communicating with people? So once they get it, do they really realise that they've got to do this, that, or the other to maintain it? And are they able to do it? One, do they have the funds to be maintaining that? Or two, do they have the ability to maintain it? So it's just use it as a good tool that right from the beginning, it's communicate and collaborate all on the same theme. So whoever you have involved on the scheme, you're all talking the same language, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then find processes to make sure that you maintain that communication, be it through virtual platforms and that, and as and where required, you seek out additional support, third party support, be a CDM advisor,
like Daniel Connell Partnership.
Maybe no, people that you can trust. I'm not joking, we'll happily help anybody as long as they want help. Always go to someone that you can trust and you enjoy working with. I don't want it to use CDM as a cash cow, so to speak. I want to enjoy doing it and helping those that want a bit of help and value your help and input. There's, as you say, a lot of people, a lot of clients will say, what's this CDM all about and why do I need it? So if people want help, then yes, love it, really enjoy it. We'll come along and help them with the areas that they specifically need help with, whether that be just pre-construction wise or health and safety fire wise or between the principal designer and principal contractor, there should be a construction phase plan developed, and whatever's in that construction phase plan is how the contractor should deliver on site. And, you know, we might be asked to do site audits just to assist from a monitoring perspective. So whatever role someone thinks, all right, I need a little bit more support here, seek out that support.
Yeah. And also, people can direct a client to this podcast if they wanted to learn more. Yeah. I mean, I certainly will be if a client wants to know a little bit more about CDM and they want to listen to it.
Yeah.
It's probably a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. CPDs is another thing. Really love educating people by providing CPDs and trying to do it in sort of one-to-one settings, so to speak, or with a, you know, whether it be someone like yourselves and we focus on a specific part of how do we discharge these duties? How can you help us make sure that we discharge these? So if, God forbid, something goes wrong in the future, how did we communicate on this? Or how did we share that information? Or how did we request that information, sort of thing? So CPDs, you know, education, everything. All the long words.
Education.
Yeah.
So if you are doing a refurbishment project or an architectural project, you need a principal designer and a principal contractor, if you've got more than one contractor, one company or one trade.
That's it. Yeah, that's correct.
And that's whether you are a residential designer or a commercial designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And if there's only one contractor involved, then designers still have duties, clients still have duties.
Thank you so much, John.
Amazing.
Right.
Hannah, do you feel like you've learned about CDM now?
Yeah, I'm not so scared of it. I definitely will look at the links that you send over and kind of go through it all, and any questions or anything that I've got, I'll send them to you. But no, I think you've covered it really well. And I'm excited about it now. I'm not so scared.
Hopefully people are still awake.
Well, we hope we've educated everybody as well, that you're feeling like you've learned something from this podcast. And if you've got any comments, please let us know, or questions for John or Hannah or me. Thank you so much, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you both. Been lovely.
Insights today.
Yeah.
And I have been hassling John for like a year to come into the podcast. So he's finally succumbed. So I'm very grateful. I know how much you really didn't want to be speaking into a microphone. So. No. Thank you.
Need a beer now.
Yeah.
If you like this episode, please like, subscribe, leave us feedback and follow the podcast on social media and YouTube. We now have a YouTube channel with a day in the life of a designer as well. If you're interested to know what we do on a day-to-day basis, podcasts coming up include an episode on planning. We've got an episode with Marianne Shillingford on colour, which is very exciting. I think maybe that would be next. Mm. So episodes coming up on the Interior Design Podcast include The Pond Man is coming next week. That's going to be brilliant, talking about aquariums in interior design. We've also got an episode with the amazing Dawn Scott from Dulux about LRVs. And also Dawn is going to do an episode with us on AI in interior design. So that's really exciting. Can't wait to do that with Dawn. Thank you so much for tuning in. And we'll see you next time.